Hi, I'm John Rawling, welcoming you to Ringside Rewind, where I'm joined by Tris Dixon and Ian Dark. And we're grateful for sponsorship from Fleet UK, a car and commercial vehicle leasing company based in Hampshire, supporting our programme. Great people who've supplied customers for 20 years or more, including me. Wherever you are, they'll find and supply any car you want and work out financing options to best suit your needs. Fleet UK pride themselves on transparency, trust and fairness in every deal. And you can take it from me, they are brilliant at what they do. Just have a look and check them out at fleetuk.com.
Hello and welcome back to Ringside Rewind with me, Tris Dixon, Ian Dark and John Rawling. This week we've actually decided to pick to talk about one of the more tricky subjects to navigate, and it's scoring in boxing and some of the worst decisions we've seen. It's not an easy thing to define because scoring is so subjective, but we have all seen our share of absolute stinkers when it comes to scorecards. I'm sure I'll mention at least one of mine as we progress. But Ian, I mean, there are some fights where, yes, scoring might be subjective, but you end up shaking your head thinking, what the heck has happened there? Like, you know, where not only the vast majority of people see the fight one way, but it seems like the only person who's seen it the other way is one of the judges or more of the judges.
Well, part of the problem, I think, is it's never really properly been clearly defined how the judge is supposed to score the fight. So they're kind of left to their own devices, aren't they? Some people like the stylists. Other people prefer brawlers, walk forward types, and give more recognition to that. So you've got that built in. And so the fighters sometimes don't understand what they've needed to do to win the fight in the eyes of some judges. Now, let's hone in straight away on one of the biggest debating or most controversial fights of all time. Marvelous Marvin Hagler, Sugar Ray Leonard. Leonard wins the fight on points. One of the judges, Jojo Guerra, has Leonard 118 to 110 ahead, 10 rounds to 2, in what is a mighty close fight, which a lot of people thought Marvin Hagler won. You know, you could argue it both ways. So many good judges saw the fight in different ways. But, you know, there it is. You know, I'm straight in, really, up to the nub of the problem here. Different people are seeing different things. So maybe we need to look a little bit closely at the exact criteria that will be scored.
Yeah, so John, I mean, quite often we hear this, particularly in America, it's what you like. Do you like the aggressor? Do you like the slick guy boxing on the outside? It's what you like. I mean, that can't really be the recipe for who wins a fight.
No, I agree with Ian. I mean, it should be defined so that when we're watching, we should have a pretty certain idea about what's a scoring blow and what's not. You know, in that Hagler-Leonard fight, to score it 8 rounds in Leonard's favour was just preposterous. You know, and the other two were split with Lou Filippo scoring it to Hagler, Dave Moretti, very experienced judge, 115, 113 for Leonard. So it was, you know, I mean, the fight was tight one way or the other, and you watch it back and you can make an argument either way. I personally think that Leonard just about did enough to edge it, but Marvin Hagler, as we know, went to the grave believing that he'd won that one, and to score it 118, 110 to Leonard is just preposterous. And Guerra afterwards admitted, I made a mistake. Well, by the time it's been done, you know, the mistake's been made and Hagler's paid the price.
Yeah, I mean, it's not just one mistake, it's several mistakes, isn't it? If he had a card that read 10 rounds to 2. I mean, that is nonsense. But I think that fight encapsulates the whole problem, because you had Leonard with all that flashy work, particularly in the last 30 seconds of rounds, to take the eye of the judges. He was very good at that. And he also had that thing, I think, where he kind of seduced the judges and seduced the media as well, with all his kind of talk ahead of the fight, fast talking and putting a lot of things in people's minds. So you always tended, I mean, I did it myself, I'll be honest with you, at that time, you kind of tended to see things his way if it was a bit close. I mean, unlike you, John, I had Leonard just, but only just. I mean, you talk to, you know, the late, great Hugh McIlvenny about that. He was never so incensed about any fight. I mean, I've been at 100 stand-up rows about that fight with journalists. I totally respect, you know, what their opinion is. So if he thought Hagler won, yeah, that's fine too. I mean, I've got no problem with either of those two cards. Lou Filippo, 115, 130 one way. Moretti, the same scoreline the other way. That's fine. It was a close fight. But yeah, I mean, Hagler always thought too, didn't he, that the Las Vegas judges hated him, basically. I'm not quite sure that was totally justified when you look at the rest of his career. But I mean, he was robbed a bit with the Antua Firmo draw, wasn't he, before he became champion. There was that. But, you know, he fought in Vegas a lot of times and got a fair deal. But yeah.
Hey, John, what did you think, Chris? How did you read that fight? So, John, let me ask you this. So I always remember watching a documentary about that fight. And there was an expert voice on it who said, because Hagler was an overwhelming favorite and he was this middleweight destroyer and Ray Leonard didn't have much form at the weight, if any form at the weight, and he'd had his injuries and all the rest of it. But basically, every round that Ray Leonard survived was a round for Ray Leonard because it was a victory of sorts. And so there was this preconceived narrative where because he was still in there pitching, he earned the round. And because Hagler hadn't wiped him out, then therefore he was losing rounds. And it was basically people filling out scorecards along with the narrative that basically they were giving Ray Leonard rounds based on survival. Now, I'm not saying that's the case or how I interpreted it, but it's very interesting to have this preconceived notion in your mind where you think someone's going to get obliterated. And then at the end of the first round, when he's still there standing, throwing punches back, you think, oh, maybe he did. Maybe he's nicked that there because he's still up on his feet and he's still in the fight. I mean, what are your thoughts on that, John?
Well, I agree with what Ian said. It's, you know, I mean, he was a very seductive presence, wasn't he, outside the ring, Leonard? And I think often people watch that fight sort of thinking, well, I like Ray Leonard and I would like him to win. And therefore, every little bit of the positive that he produced, people were going in that direction. I mean, think about Floyd and Canelo, Floyd Mayweather and Canelo. You know, I mean, I watched that fight. I commentated that fight for Box Nation. And I personally thought that Floyd Mayweather absolutely schooled Canelo that night. And had it been an 8 or 9 point margin, I would absolutely have not argued the toss about that. As it was 117, 111, 116, 112. And then from somewhere, a judge called CJ Ross, a female judge who she'd scored Pacquiao Bradley in the past as well, so she wasn't without experience of doing big fights. She scored the fight level, which was just absolutely staggering. Because, I mean, what on earth did Canelo do in that fight to merit coming out of it as a draw on any card? You know, I mean, at risk of being politically incorrect and doing the popular cliche, I don't think Stevie Wonder could have failed to score that one, right?
So I think, you know, I'm glad you mentioned that one, John, because, you know, I remember I covered that fight ringside and, you know, when they read out it was a majority decision, I was like, surely not. I'd scored every round to Mayweather. I'd scored at 120, 108. It would be in virtuoso performance. You know, I couldn't see him really losing a minute of the round. Canelo was where Mayweather wanted him to be at any point of the fight. Floyd dictated everything as far as I recall. And then when they announced the majority decision, I'm like, hey. And then when they said that there was that scorecard, I was like, that was one of the things that jumped out at me is I feel like I want to leave Boxing News now because how do I justify this? How do I say to the readers that someone has scored this fight a draw when it's been a completely one-sided exhibition? How do you justify it?
Well, there are some fighters down there. I mean, I don't think it applies in this case because Mayweather was a big ticket seller as well. But Canelo, of course, sells a huge amount of tickets and his massive box office, particularly on the Cinco de Mayo holiday in Las Vegas, the 5th of May thing. So they always put him on, don't they, in a big one on that date. And this is kind of built in. I mean, it shouldn't be. And it's maybe people might listen to this and say, well, that's a bit of a scurrilous accusation. But I think it does play in. The guy who is the commercial hot ticket, the marquee fighter, people want to keep him in business. So does that play into the scoring as well sometimes? Let me tell you something that Richard Steele, the top referee in Vegas around the era, told me once. He said, we were in a bar having a drink, a few of us, and he said something he shouldn't have said, really. He said, let me tell you guys something. He said, Mike Tyson's never going to lose a decision in this town. I said, that's outrageous. He said, I know, but he said, I'm just telling you. So that kind of confirmed suspicions to me.
We thought the same about Canelo, didn't we? You know, he was the darling of Las Vegas and the huge box office. I mean, look at that first fight against Golovkin. I totally failed to see how you could not give that to Golovkin. It was given a draw, and I thought Golovkin won the rematch as well. Both were rescored by independent judges working for a program on DAZN, and both scored scored the first fight in Golovkin's favor, and two out of three scored the second fight in Golovkin's favor. And I mean, I walked away from those fights sort of shaking my head in disbelief. And somebody said to me, well, how do you think Billy Joe Saunders would get on against Canelo? And that was a talking point at the time. And I said, well, I don't think it really matters, because even if he wins the fight, he ain't going to get the decision. And that was absolutely how I felt after watching those Golovkin fights.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think Golovkin won them. Yeah. But again, it's just that exactly underlines the point I think I was making, that Golovkin, for all his brilliance, wasn't the marquee name, was he? So they want to keep big shows going with Canelo. I mean, who is obviously a top type operator himself. But you know, some people get the benefit of the doubt a bit more than others. I think, you know, if we're honest, and probably he'd admit it now, Chris Eubank got the benefit of the doubt a few times, didn't he?
Definitely. And you look ahead to what's coming up in Saudi, coming up to the Tyson Fury fight over there. You know, I mean, the Ukrainian is going to have to win that fight so big to deny Tyson Fury, in my opinion, because Tyson Fury is the cash cow. He's huge.
Well, I think more to the point with that, going to the Saudi thing, obviously there's this big bill on December 23rd where Anthony Joshua is expected to beat Otto Wallin and Deontay Wilder is expected to beat Joseph Parker to make a big fight between Wilder and Joshua next year. Well, does this mean that we've already got some inference as to what the scorecards might be if we ever get to the scorecards? Because if you remember, when Oscar De La Hoya fought Felix Sturm, they were hell-bent on making the Hopkins fight for Oscar. And he seemed very fortunate to get through that Felix Sturm fight, but they already had this massive fight to go to.
Yeah, that was a robbery. The Sturm fight, that was a robbery. It robbed him blind there, and there was a script kicking in, obviously. I mean, that's another problem, isn't it, Chris? None of this should be like this. I mean, I think we've got to make it clear here. We're not accusing anybody of corruption as such, but there are a lot of factors playing into scoring that probably shouldn't be factoring in. So if you're sitting there with your pencil and, you know, and a bit of paper to score the round in front of you, and it's a kind of even round, do you sort of lean unconsciously towards the guy who is, how can I put it, expected to win, or he's the promoter's fighter, etc.? I don't know, but it seems to us, and we've covered it a long time, you know, and we've that feeling John described is sometimes you throw your pen down and go, what the hell's going on? You know,
John, you had that, by the way, with another Sturm fight with Matt Macklin, right?
I thought that fight was a very close fight. I know Matt felt that he'd been robbed there, didn't he? But I thought Felix Sturm was an underrated fighter. I'd quite a lot of time for him. And I wouldn't put that down as one of the really big ones in my third time watching it. There were others. I mean, like Holyfield Lewis, for instance, the first one of those. Talks about throwing your pen down. I threw my pen down and basically said, that's a .. disgrace. Well, I thought that was just appalling that Lewis didn't get that.
Well, the New York Post headline the next morning, front page headline on the newsstands in, you know, around Madison Square Garden was "It stinks." Great big letter. It stinks. I mean, this is the famous Eugenia Williams scorecard, isn't it? Where, I mean, if you were getting somebody off the street or teaching a kid and say, this is how you score rounds. 10 points to the guy who's won the round, 9 to the fellow who lost the round. Here's a very clear-cut round. It's very easy to score which fighters won this round. The fifth round of that fight, that Lennox is battering Holyfield, and she scored the round to Holyfield and later claimed, oh, I couldn't really see properly because Lennox was obscuring my view.
I mean, honestly, his fists crashing into Evander Holyfield's head.
I mean, she's scoring a major heavyweight championship fight. I mean, how did that ever happen? How did that ever happen? I mean, and then Larry O'Connell, bless him, you know, the British judge there. I mean, his card comes out. I mean, as they announced it, they announced the one for Lewis, then they announced the one for Holyfield. We were all going, what? And I'm thinking, well, it's Larry O'Connell now, the last card. So Lennox is going to get the decision he so very clearly deserved. And his card was a draw. I mean, we spoke to Larry afterwards. He said, oh, I thought I'd scored it for Lennox. But, you know, it came out level.
Do you know what's funny about this, Ian? Do you know what? For the longest time as well in boxing, and you guys will remember this, it was almost standard practice that you would have a judge for the home fighter, a judge for the away fighter's country, and a neutral judge in the middle. Like, that's just bonkers anyway. And the acceptance was that the home judge would go for the home fighter, the away judge would go for the away fighter, and the neutral judge would tip the balance as to who actually deserved who would win. It's crazy to have a discussion like this, but that was it, wasn't it?
Yeah. So how should it be done? How should that be done in future? Because before we came on air, so to speak, with this podcast, you and I, Tris, were having a little conversation. And we were saying, well, who actually pays for the judges? You know, who pays their hotel bills and flights and that when they come to a fight? Is it the governing body or is it the promoters? If it's the promoters, I would argue that there's an area of them being compromised.
Well, there's also, you know, they've got their affiliations to the different sanctioning bodies as well. So they're representing the different sanctioning bodies. So, yeah, and I mean, I think the thing is as well, there's payment, but there's also this murky area of expenses, isn't there, in terms of, you know, what hotels are they going in and what's their budget and who's laying on that? And are they going to feel obligated one way or another to see things a certain way? And you know, this is accepted also in boxing. And we've talked about some massive fights here in Las Vegas and New York. But also at four-round level, at local level, wherever you are in the world, there's this common acceptance, even from the people in the blue corner, the journeymen, that they're never going to get a decision because they're not the ones selling tickets. So they go up there, they expect this 40-36 or 60-54 scorecard to be read out, even if they've won a fight. And then they shake their heads and they trundle off and they're like, okay, well, at least I'm not cut. I can fight again next week. And then, yeah. And it's almost like an unwritten thing, isn't it? It's just a rite of passage for people to go out and get screwed. I mean, you can't legislate for it. The amount of people I've seen ripped off on the small hall circuit, I mean, it's painful.
And they don't argue the toss about it. It's the guy who's been beaten who's effectively the journeyman. Because if they really stand up and wave their arms and create a stink, they ain't going to get booked again. And that the journeyman relies on fighting every couple of weeks to earn whatever it is and make a living that way. He's not there to win, and he knows it.
But occasionally, and you've covered them as well, John, I'm sure you too, Tris, where we've sat there watching the undercard and there are some good little scraps and you're thinking, he's, you know, this prospect that the promoter's trying to beef up and sell to us, he's no prospect at all. He's not going to make it. He's ordinary. He lost that fight. But like Tris said, they very, very rarely have their hand raised at the end of it. So, you know, there's a little subculture as well going on in the sport. I mean, It's not right, is it? But I really don't know what the answer is to it. It's kind of the DNA of boxing, isn't it?
So there was a fight in America in the late 90s, a heavyweight fight. Matt Christie recently talked about this on the Boxing News podcast, where I think they had three judges, and they all scored round by round. But what they did was they took an aggregate of each round. So you had three judges, and whoever got the majority from the three judges, so say round one was scored in favor of fighter A by two judges, but fighter B scored it, but fighter B was scored for the other card, then fighter A took the round. And they were doing it that way. Unfortunately, they got it on a fight between two knockout merchants, and they only got to about the fifth round, so the scorecards were irrelevant. But I did think that kind of thing, but perhaps with five neutral judges, impartial judges, could work, because then you're not allowing for that same margin for error where someone's just gone off on a tangent for 12 rounds.
Yeah. Well, that's where the amateur game went, isn't it? After the Roy Jones business in the Olympics, they changed the scoring system there. And I mean, has the amateur game been better for that?
Well, no, because of the bribery and corruption. You know, we know that in the Olympics and Worlds that medals have been bought. We actually know that. That's fact. But it did go to computer scoring. I suppose that's another debate entirely, but one worth having, because, you know, CompuBox get a lot of criticism for their stats or, you know, people don't buy into the stats, but they always do kind of tell the story of the fight. There's not many fights where they really don't tell the story unless they're left redundant. You know, for example, there was a fight between Mickey Ward and there was a Mexican body puncher years ago, and the guy outboxed Mickey Ward for six rounds, and Mickey wasn't even in the fight, and then he just turned it around with a one punch body shot knockout. And so whatever the punch stats were, it didn't make any difference at the end. But sometimes I think there is weight behind punch stats, but then, you know, it's a different thing, isn't it? If you've got someone who's maybe scored 10 punches in a round or landed 10 good shots in a round, but someone's landed four really damaging blows and had someone rocking and rolling, who would you score the round to? Because,
well,
you
that's
know,
where we go back to the criteria thing, and where it has to be laid down a bit more clearly exactly what is going to be scored. But, you know, John mentioned the Roy Jones fiasco, you know, the 1988 Olympic Games, you know, when he was just, you know, he'd won so very clearly, and they give it to the South Korean. I'll give one as well. At the LA Olympics, a guy called, I think it was Angelo Musone, an Italian, fighting Henry Tillman, who was from Los Angeles, host city, to the games. Clearly, Musone had won the fight. They gave it to Tillman. And guess what, though? The crowd, all big boxing fans, booed the decision to the echo around the arena, that even though it was the hometown decision, they knew what they'd seen, and they knew what they'd seen was a scandal. And Harry Carpenter, I remember, I was working for radio. Harry was sitting right in front of me, and he put a huge, he was so angry, he put this big red line right through his notes for the fight, screwed up the piece of paper and threw it at the ring. Wow. I mean, it was that outrageous.
Harry wasn't one of the most belligerent men you ever met either, was it? It took a lot to make him do that.
Yes. Well, talking to Harry, of course, brings us very nicely to Henry Cooper against Joe Bugner, 1971, which we need to sort of set the scene for that, I think, for our younger listeners here, because we're going back in time a bit. But it is a very, very interesting one, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, Henry was 37. He was right at the tail end of his career, and he'd said before the fight, I'm going to retire either way after this one. Joe Bugner was a young, unbeaten prospect, just turned 21, and they fought a very close fight. But Harry, at the end of it, came out with those immortal words, which I think probably certainly changed Joe Bugner's life thereafter, because it turned the British public against it. He said about the referee, Harry Gibbs, who was scoring the fight, he's given it to Bugner, and I find that amazing. How can you take the man's three titles away like that? And with that, Joe Bugner became almost public enemy number one thereafter. And despite phenomenal performances like that losing effort against Joe Frazier at Earl's Court a couple of years later, despite that, the British public never at all warmed to him. And I think it was a shame, but it just goes to show in those days the power that a commentator had. And Harry Carpenter certainly had it.
Yeah, and Henry Cooper didn't talk to Harry Gibbs for 28 years after that. And of course, Henry was the nicest man. I mean, he deserved his reputation of national treasure. You remember something else at the end of that fight, that Henry walked over to Harry Gibbs and held out his hand for him to lift it. It had turned out that Harry Gibbs had had the fight level after, you know, before the last round, and Henry had rather coasted the last round. Bugner had stolen it, and he gave the decision to Bugner instead. But, Bugner always said that I didn't really win that. I was kind of chased out of my own beautiful country, as he said. You know, he never really did gain that popularity until possibly very late in his career when he came back and, you know, had that Indian summer with Frank Warren and had his fight and payday with Frank Bruno.
But the effect that referees can have can be enormous. In those days, a fight was judged by the referee. So Harry Gibbs was the only one scoring that. And as you say, he scored it to Bugner by the narrowest of margins. And I promise people who've not seen this fight, you know, watch it back. Watch the whole fight back on YouTube and see what you think. I think there's a very persuasive argument that Joe Bugner did win that fight. I don't think in any sense that Henry Cooper was robbed, you know. And you look at other fights, like when Sven Otker fought Robin Reed for the world title in 2003, was it, over in Nuremberg, WBA and IBF titles. Otker had a history of getting huge hometown decisions. And the referee for that one was a Belgian fella called Roger Tillemans, who may be one of the least competent referees who's ever stepped through the ropes. His performance was extraordinary, to the extent that Robin Reed had a point deducted at one stage for landing a punch to Otker's chin. I mean, work that one out.
Yeah, there was a few in Germany for Otker, wasn't there? And I think, you know, he's on the ballot for the International Boxing Hall of Fame, and it's probably going to be his reputation for getting hometown decisions that means he won't ever go in. I mean, it's tough, isn't it? It's tough. It's, you know, because he was unbeaten in 34 fights, only scored 6 stoppages, so he did need the judges on his side. But he did have them a bit too often. And, you know, it's sad for Robin Reed, because that was a life-changing fight, really. That could have opened up more doors for a real Cinderella patch of Robin's career, but that was that.
Robin was on the wrong side more than once, wasn't he? And I'm sure if you talk to him now, have you done him for your Boxing Life stories?
Because yes, he was the 200th guest. He was brilliant, yeah.
Well, I'm sure Robin would say right now that he would still believe that he beat Joe Calzaghe.
Yeah, I mean, that was a tough fight, wasn't it? Joe will admit it was right up there as one of his toughest, alongside Eubank and some of the other wars that Joe had. But Robin was unfortunate in that respect. He really, really was. My heart goes out to him. And for a lot of the people who travelled on the road and got turned away with a bad decision. We had Derek Chisora, who's maybe not the most sympathetic figure, got really badly shafted against Robert Hellenius for the European title. You hate to say it happens. And I mean, I remember Frank Warren has this great throwaway line, which I've often thought is the same thing, where he sort of shrugs his shoulders and he just says, "That's boxing."
Yeah.
But I hate to agree with it. I mean, I'm not saying it's right, but... And I'm not
it
saying
it is right, is it?
No, it's not right. It's not right. But that is the nature of the beast and all this stuff we've talked about, from 4-round level to the amateurs. By the way, as well, I mean, talking about the Roy Jones debacle in 1988, there was obviously this glaring admission about how badly they'd screwed up, because they gave him the Val Barker Award for being the best boxer in the tournament.
Yes, yes.
You know, well, why would you give it to a guy who didn't even win his weight class?
Didn't win the gold medal, but boxing nearly got thrown out of the Olympics for that, didn't it? There was such a stink about that worldwide. Was saying, do we need all this? I mean, one that really, really angered me was little Michael Brody from Manchester, who had a very, very tough life and fully deserved the decision over that guy, Willie Horreen, who he fought.
Oh, God, yeah.
Didn't get it. That was an absolute... I was raging at that. I mean, there was a bomb scare just after the fight that night. And Bob Logist, one of the judges, was outside, and I was still absolutely boiling. And he wandered over and he said, oh, well, this is it's a bit cold out here, isn't it? I said, Bob, I said, what book was it you were reading during that fight? I said, how have you scored that for Horreen? I said, you would have to have been wearing a blindfold. And he goes, oh, well, you know, and he gave that kind of answer. He goes, well, you know, we all have got our opinions.
Talking about Brody, he had that war with Injun Chi, didn't he? I think they fought twice. And once he was very, very good. And then the second, I think not getting the decisions he hadn't got in his career just took everything out of Michael Brody. But that first fight, do you remember as well? And you guys would have judged on a few of these. I think that there was real issues with the scorecards, and there was time, you know, I can't remember the specifics, but it was definitely one of those where there's time passing and you're thinking, what's going on with the scorecards here? Why is it taking so long?
You're thinking the fix is on, aren't you? That's
It's like, well, what's so hard between adding up these fights where you're scoring round by round in a 12 round fight? It's what's the hitch? Have they realized something that's not, you know, and it has happened actually. You know, I've seen it happen. I couldn't remember off the top of my head which one it is, but someone's actually scored one fight for the other person and they've mixed up their tallies and it, you know, it's gone through. I mean, this stuff happens, but when there's a long wait for the scorecards to be read out, you are thinking, what the hell's going on? It's not rocket science. Yeah.
I mean, as a commentator, this all makes our job very, very difficult because, you know, this is one of the few sports that you're watching. You don't actually know who's winning. You have to give the viewers an idea of who you think is winning. But I was kept on having to build bridges back. I remember doing that Holyfield-Lewis first fight in New York, which we were saying Lewis is comfortably winning. But I remember saying it about the 10th round. But I said, we've got to remember here that you can never take anything for granted with the judges in America. We're on a fight promoted by an American promoter, Don King, with an American heavyweight involved in it. So I wouldn't want to second guess the judges. So let's take nothing for granted. I mean, those proved to be that proved to be quite relevant as things turned out.
Well, we had it with Fury against Wilder, didn't we? First one over in LA. You know, I think it was very difficult to make a coherent argument for Wilder winning anything until he puts Fury down and then had him down again in the last round. So that's two 10-8 rounds in Wilder's favour in theory. But I thought Fury won the rest and won them clearly. And when it came round as draw, you know, you think, well, what on earth's this about?
Yeah, that one probably doesn't get talked about enough for me. You know, I agree with you, John. That was a stinker for me. And I think part of the reason why it doesn't get talked about enough is because Fury took the draw with such good grace. But for me, I couldn't give Wilder that fight or even a share of the fight.
It's a good job he did, Triz. If he hadn't done, there might have been a riot there that night because there were a lot of fairly passionate Fury fans around, and if Tyson had argued the toss and said that's a disgrace and really made a big thing of it, it could have been a very nasty situation that night.
But Fury's interesting because he obviously he was on the good side of one earlier in his career, wasn't he, with John McDermott?
Yeah, a lot of people thought that he lost that fight, and I think John McDermott was very unlucky not to get that decision. I remember that one clearly, and it was an awful performance from Fury that night, and McDermott is probably the best performance of his career, and he never got the reward.
Yeah, it's tough. It's tough. It's
costly fighters, isn't it? If you're the unfashionable fighter, the one who's on the wrong end of this, it's costing you or could cost you millions of dollars down the road.
Well, how much has it changed? You know, people listening to this, when we say, oh, John McDermott against Tyson Fury, they'll say, John who? You know, a lot of people, and that's and look at how it's changed for Tyson Fury. He's now got godzillions in the bank, and John McDermott, pretty much in relative terms, has nothing. And that it's as, it can be as brutal as that when you get a decision going what many would see the wrong way.
I suppose a lot of people listening to this will think, my goodness me, listen to these three. Boxing's a pretty corrupt business. We've kind of dragged boxing's name through the mud. I mean, I think we should add, I think that most of the people doing the job of scoring fights are doing a very honest job, and their experience, you know, and there are a lot of good judges out there, like, you know, somebody like Stan Christodoulou, you know, who scored that fight for Lewis, the Holyfield fight, among many other good cards that he produced. So, and there are good judges in Vegas who've scored fights about right, but we are kind of accentuating the bad ones, aren't we, here?
So, but yeah, I mean, that's the point of this podcast, isn't it? I mean, in this particular episode, the thing is we expect a level of competence, you know. So you're a bit, I feel like Roy Keane in that clip, you know, he's done his job, Ian. What are you giving him credit for? He's just done his job. He scored a fight the way it should be scored. But one thing I do like is that the guys who do go back and rectify these near losses and stuff, you know, Floyd was nearly beaten by Castillo and he went back and did a better job. Fury was nearly beaten by McDermott and he went back and did a better job. Wilder was nearly beaten by Fury and he gave Fury another shot. And obviously it didn't work out for Wilder. But there's something to be said for the ones where there's the immediate rematch, because there's an aftertaste from the ones where we never get it settled, like a Leonard Hagler, which we're still talking about all these years on. And most recently, I suppose, I'm not sure if either of you covered it, but Jack Catchrell and Josh Taylor, which was quite an outrageous one.
It was. Yeah, it really was. I mean, and that's like on the money front, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it was...
They should have done the rematch by now.
Yeah.
I still hope that it happens. I mean, there'll be no title on the line this time, presumably, but they're still sort of kind of fighting the title of who's the superior man, because there is the widespread belief within the sport that Catterall was sawn off in that first one, that he should have got the verdict.
Well, he should have done. Not much doubt about it.
Yeah, yeah. Well...
So a big question then, Ian, what do you, I mean, I don't want to say this, but what do you like and how would you score a fight? And is there a hard and fast thing? I mean, just while I give you the time to think about this, Adam Booth has this idea where you split a round into 3 minutes and you basically score each portion of the round for who's won that minute. And at the end of it, the person who's won the most of the rounds or the won the most of the minute, the most of that session has won the round. I kind of get that and I kind of like it. But then you're also not, and you don't really want to favour a natural puncher who inflicts damage with one shot over someone who's been peppering him with jabs for a couple of minutes. So it is tough. It is hard. But do you have a hard and fast solution? And is there a particular way that you do it I suppose you don't have to do round by round when you're working, because you're doing the blow by blow. So I don't know, people won't understand that, but you're not best placed to do it, because you need to actually be very reactive and talking about stuff rather than checking back to what happened a minute ago or 45 seconds ago.
Kind of go on the effective aggression thing, not just somebody walking forward, flailing away and hitting arms, you know, proper punches. I think that's a big thing. And I think you just gain an impression as you're talking and watching at very close range of who's bossing the round, who's dictating. So often it's very, very close. There, we probably should have, I think, a little more elasticity in the scoring system. So maybe you should score it 10-9, score every round to one fighter or the other, and say 10-9 if it's on a close round, 10-8 if one fighter's won the round emphatically, 10-7 if he's won the round with a knockdown, 10-6 if there have been two knockdowns. So there's a little more play in the scoring, because on big world title fights, the judges are told you always find a winner for every round. They don't score 10 rounds. Maybe they should a little more. So I think if you built that in, I think that would be helpful, because if I've nearly won the fight in one round and the guy's just survived and all I get is 10-9, same as if the judge thought I just edged a close round. So I always felt that was slightly wrong.
Yeah, allow me to play devil's advocate here, John, and I'll ask you this. So say someone's done what Ian's just said and someone's been hammered around the ring for 3 minutes or 2 minutes 55, and then they go and pull out a bazooka of a right hand and nail someone to the floor and they just about beat the count. Who should have won the round?
Well, it's going to go down on most cards as a 10-8 for the guy who's put the bloke down, isn't it? Which you can argue is very wrong. The system is flawed like that, and it needs to be spelled out, I think, in black and white by people who are officiating and have overall jurisdiction over the titles, if you like, the WBA, WBC, IBF, whatever. I think that it needs to be written down exactly the criteria on which a fight will be scored. So that if that were to happen, Tris, you know, you'd say, well, in that case, it should be a 10-10, or it should be maybe just a 10-9 to the guy who's had the knockdown. But it needs to be put down in black and white, I think, to eliminate this sort of discussion.
Yeah, I think there's a lot more. I do agree with Ian. I think there's a lot more to play with in terms of the score and in terms of point deduction, so that you do wind up with wider scorecards. And obviously, it's a massive break in protocol to rip up the 10-point must system. But I think it could and maybe should be where it's going. And I think you've got to reward these people who aren't just nicking rounds. And I think if they are nicking rounds, then they'll just keep nicking the rounds, which is fine. But you do need to be able to measure that degree of success. And I think that's where Ian talks about, you know, I'm fully on board with that. 10-9 score either way, 10-8 if it's clear. And by the way, a clear round doesn't have to be, you know, where someone's landed 45 punches and the other guy's landed 47. It could be someone's landed 6 shots and the other guy's not landed a bean. You know, I think that's quite a clear round, you know, because he's been in control and the guy's had no success whatsoever. So, you know, you get those feeling out rounds at the start as well, which people don't know which way to call. So that generally there's a lot of 10-10s when you're feeling each other out. But I think, you know, I think still it's not hard to see that certainly in those early rounds where so little often lands, it's not hard to see who's had the better of the exchanges. It's really not, or it shouldn't be. But blimey, sometimes it feels like it's impossible for some people.
Don't worry, they'll soon have robots, artificial intelligence, calling the fights. Yeah, there's your answer.
Well, hey, I mean... You joke
close
about
rounds like that, to where you have big disparities one way or the other, and that's where you get your controversial scorecards, isn't it? Because if you've got these tight rounds, which really probably should have been scored level, but they're given one way or the other, and that can bring a very misleading representation of the fight.
Well, I'm glad you said that, because there's something there as well. I do think that fights have to be scored with a degree of common sense. So say you're 7 rounds into a fight and it's been nip and tuck all the way, and there's not been a lot happening. But if you've given a couple of rounds to one person or most of the rounds to one person and it's still close. And I'm trying to think of how best to say this. Say maybe 4, maybe... maybe not 7 rounds in, but maybe 3 rounds in, and still not much has happened. And you've given the first 3 rounds to someone else, but, you know, the next one could go either way. You know, might be a 10-10. I would be tempted to say, well, I'm going to score for this guy because it's not the guy's not 4 rounds in front. There's not 4 rounds difference in a fight. You're going to end up with a lopsided scorecard if you don't start turning things around and actually giving the guy some credit for some work, if there's not much in it at all.
Yeah. Now, I think we would unconsciously do that a little bit, Tris.
Yeah, I don't think that's a bad thing, because it means that you don't go off on this wild tangent where, you know, and I'm not saying, you know, you're deliberately trying to skew scorecards in someone's favor. I'm saying if not much has happened and it's an even fight, then after four rounds and your scorecard looks even, you're about where you need to be anyway.
Here's an idea. What about this? This is something else. I mean, I only throw this out for discussion. What about at the end of the fight? So you get a scorecard, you're adding up the 12 rounds, that every judge then there is an extra, say, 10 points or something toward it. You say, who do you think won that fight in the end? Like it's like a bonus ball almost at the end.
Well, that really does open it to potential corruption, doesn't it? Because the guy, you know, you're basically forgetting everything that you've seen, and you're just saying, who do you think won? And that's open to all sorts of dodgy pressure, and basically somebody saying, okay, well, X might have won every round, but I'm going to give it the other way because that's the way I think it should go.
Oh, okay. I'll correct it then. Say a judge has scored the fight level, he's then got a kind of casting vote to say, well, actually, if you wanted to say a winner, I'm going to say, you know, Castillo.
Yeah, so that's not a bad thing. We know what the scorecards look like, round 1 to 12, right? And then you could have a box at the bottom where you tick and you just think, who do you think's got it on balance?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's I'd go with that. There's sense in that one.
But then it's a strange one, isn't it? Because if, you know, imagine these scorecards being made public, and you've gone with fighter B, thinking, oh yeah, I think he's got it, but your scorecard actually reads for fighter A. Then what happens?
I think that's
you decide, and however you change it, we're always going to be sitting down debating this one. As long as there are judges, it's inevitable that there are going to be moments when it's going to be contentious.
Well, I do wonder if AI is a thing, you know, it might be where we end up with these gloves that actually read shots and clear landing, you know, clear punches, whether to the body or head. We might wind up with technology that, and I see Ian rolling his head as a football commentator who's had to deal with VAR for the last couple of years.
Yeah.
We might wind up with technology that actually does tell us who's been more successful in a fight. I mean, we can't predict that, but I don't know. It's tough. I mean, I don't know if there's a... Sorry, Ian.
Going back to that Ray Leonard one, Leonard landed 306 punches and Hagler 251. So does it tell you the strength of the punches, the power?
I mean, does it matter? Does it matter if someone's been peppering you with 300 plus punches and you've only landed 250 or whatever? Does it matter how strong the punches are? Because if you're a non-puncher, what's the point of even doing it?
Well, everyone who was at that Hagler fight said, you know, including the late great Hugh McIlvenny, that the quality of Hagler's punches were, you know, they were much more solid punches. And he thought everything Leonard was landing, or nearly everything, was pitter-patter for show stuff.
But that was the tactics, wasn't it? I mean, and Hagler got it tactically wrong, coming out orthodox in the first place. But, I mean, yeah, there's so much here, isn't there? There's so much stuff to debate and discuss. John, you look poised to interject.
I'm just trying to stop myself sneezing. I'm having to do being washed with a fairly hideous bad cold.
I mean, Ian, did you do any of the Pernell Whitaker ones against Chavez or Ramirez?
Don't think I did many Pernell Whitaker, no.
No, because Pernell was on the wrong end of some bad ones as well. But I mean, again, you would imagine that when you look at someone like Chavez, who's an aggressive body puncher, and Pernell, who actually was an underrated attacking fighter, but who people think was a back foot gifted southpaw who was on the move and all the rest of it. There's a preconceived notion that one guy is going to be the aggressor and the other guy is going to be boxing and moving. So what do you like? And obviously that wound up being enormously controversial. I don't know, John. I mean, I asked Ian, you know, how do you do this? I mean, what is fair, and is there a solution?
well, we've talked about it for so long. As long as I've been covering boxing, we've seemed to have had this discussion. And I don't think we're any closer to a solution than we were 30 years ago. You know, as you said, Frank Warren walks away shrugging his shoulders saying, well, that's boxing. And unfortunately, I'm afraid that's the case. And talking about that Chavez-Whitaker fight, that's another case, isn't it, of Chavez being the huge ticket seller who they wanted to win. And Pernell Whitaker, for all his technical brilliance, was not somebody who would get people talking about, you know, you wouldn't find people walking down Fifth Avenue saying, hey, did you see that Pernell Whitaker last night? You know, he wasn't like that. And unfortunately, as long as there's boxing and as long as there's judges, you'll be having that sort of conversation.
I think one thing they've got to think about is more training for the judges. So you have to qualify to become a top scorer of fights. You have to go through a pretty rigorous process. I'm not sure, does that happen? I mean, I think it happens to some extent with, say, the Nevada State Athletic Commission or the British Boxing Board of Control. But maybe that is something that could be stepped up, that you have to kind of almost pass exams in showing that you know how to read fights and score and can be relied on.
Yeah, and I'd be very much up for relegation of judges for bad decisions for a certain amount of time.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Or being dragged in, as a couple have done. I think they called a grand jury, didn't they? In the Manhattan District Attorney called a grand jury, which Eugenia Williams had to appear in front of to explain how on earth she scored the fight for Holyfield. But, you know,
what was the jury's verdict? That's politics.
The jury scored it a draw. I think so.
It was a no decision.
The foreman came out and said, we have a split decision.
Did they have Michael Buffer? Brilliant, brilliant. Oh, well, gents, I mean, there's probably not much more meat on the bone with this one, but it's really interesting. I think there is a lot that can be done with boxing to change it. I don't think what we've got now is satisfactory because, you know, these decisions ultimately are life-changing. You know, some of the guys now that of the fights that we've spoken about who've been on the wrong end of these decisions, they have, you know, had they won those fights, their next fight, they would have been able to buy a house outright, or they might have been able to retire after one more fight or two more fights. As it is, their pay goes down and they're struggling to make ends meet for some of them for the rest of their lives. And these decisions do change the trajectory, not just of careers, but of lives.
And how many times have we sat at ringside after seeing something contentious saying, well, the obvious thing is there has to be a rematch. But on many occasions, that rematch never comes because the guy who's been sawn off, who's been robbed, he's probably not the ticket seller. And he's probably not the one who would actually, that people would go out and buy a ticket to watch the rematch, if you see where I'm coming from. So these guys come up short. And economically, their lives change through not getting the decision, and then they don't get the rematch they deserve.
And the upshot of it all is that the casual boxing fans are turned off the sport when they see these injustices.
Yeah, that's true too. Yeah, that's true. So anyway, I think so we don't have any solutions. We've been ranting and raving for nearly an hour. We can't fix it. It is broken. There's nothing we can do. There's nothing we can think about doing. And long may it continue. And in those words, that's boxing. So in another phrase, that is Ringside Rewind for this week. I'm Tris Dixon, as always, being joined by Ian Dark and your ruling. Gents, thank you so much for your time, and we'll be back soon.
Cheers, guys.
Cheers.
Hi, I'm John Rawling, welcoming you to Ringside Rewind, where I'm joined by Tris Dixon and Ian Dark. And we're grateful for sponsorship from Fleet UK, a car and commercial vehicle leasing company based in Hampshire, supporting our programme. Great people who've supplied customers for 20 years or more, including me. Wherever you are, they'll find and supply any car you want and work out financing options to best suit your needs. Fleet UK pride themselves on transparency, trust and fairness in every deal. And you can take it from me, they are brilliant at what they do. Just have a look and check them out at fleetuk.com.